All right, let's deep dive into a Supreme Court case that feels ripped from the headlines, Gilbert v. California.
From 1967, no less.
1967, that's right. But it still matters today, especially when we're talking about lineups and that tricky balance between getting evidence and protecting your constitutional rights.
You're hitting on those Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights. It really makes you think, where's the line between good police work and, well, maybe crossing that line?
Okay, so we've got armed robbery, we've got murder of a police officer, and we've got this lineup happening in a packed auditorium with over 100 witnesses.
Over 100? Wow. That's pretty wild.
Yeah. Definitely not what we're used to seeing these days when we think about lineups. It's a lot more controlled now, isn't it?
Yeah, much more.
Okay, so back to the beginning. Who is this Jesse James Gilbert and what got him into all this legal trouble?
Well, Jesse James Gilbert was convicted of armed robbery.
Okay.
And the murder of a police officer.
Why?
And two big pieces of evidence they used against him were a handwriting sample that was taken without his lawyer and that dramatic post-indictment lineup we talked about, also without a lawyer present.
So those two pieces of evidence, that's what the Supreme Court was really looking at, right? Trying to figure out if using those violated Gilbert's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination or his Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
Exactly. Now, there was a third issue that the court was looking at about statements made by Gilbert's co-defendant.
Yeah.
But that ended up going back to the lower courts.
Okay.
We're really focusing on the handwriting and the lineup today because those were the elements that really shaped the legal precedent here.
So let's take these one by one. Let's start with those handwriting samples or exemplars. What did the court decide?
So the court ultimately said that handwriting samples aren't considered testimonial evidence.
Interesting.
So they don't fall under that Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination.
Okay.
They basically looked at it as less about what you're saying and more about a physical characteristic, kind of like your fingerprints.
Oh, interesting. So they basically put a handwriting sample and a fingerprint in the same category. Why is that distinction so important?
Well, it really gets at the heart of what that Fifth Amendment is trying to protect, which is your right to remain silent, to not be forced to testify against yourself.
Right.
The court was essentially saying your handwriting, like a fingerprint, is just inherently you. It's not a statement you're choosing to make. It's just part of who you are physically.
I see. So it's less about like the content of what you write and more about the physical act of writing itself.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost like saying your height or your eye color can't be used to incriminate you.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay.
And the court also decided that taking these handwriting exemplars, it doesn't count as a critical stage in a legal process.
Okay.
So that means your Sixth Amendment right to counsel, to have your lawyer there, doesn't apply in that situation.
I see.
They didn't see it as a moment where having a lawyer present would fundamentally change things or give you an unfair advantage.
Makes sense. If not, like a lawyer could like coach you on how to change your handwriting in that moment.
Right, exactly. And the court reasoned that handwriting analysis is usually done by experts.
Right.
Who are trained to look for those really unique subconscious characteristics in how someone writes.
Oh, wow.
Not just like the surface level things you could easily change or manipulate.
Okay, so it's considered a pretty objective piece of evidence then, not easily influenced.
Yeah.
That's fascinating how the court draws these lines between different kinds of evidence.
Yeah, it is. And those lines get even more interesting when we talk about the lineup identifications, where the court actually took a totally different stance.
Okay, so let's shift gears and talk about the lineup then.
Hmm.
Why did the court decide that you absolutely need a lawyer present at a lineup when they didn't think it was necessary for taking handwriting samples? What's so different about those two situations?
Well, they basically declared that any lineup that happens after a person's been indicted is a critical stage, which means the defendant has a right to have their lawyer there, no exceptions.
So that auditorium lineup they did without Gilbert's lawyer?
Yeah.
That was a big no-no from the start then.
Yes, it was a problem. And it gets a little more complicated because the court also ruled that later in-court identifications by those same witnesses might be inadmissible too if they were influenced by that bad lineup.
Wow.
So they created this thing called a per se exclusionary rule just for these kinds of situations.
Okay, hold on. Let's break that down. What exactly is a per se exclusionary rule in this context?
It basically means any testimony that's based on an unconstitutional lineup, like we had in Gilbert's case, is automatically thrown out as evidence unless the prosecution can really prove otherwise.
Wow.
Like they'd have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that in-court identification came from somewhere completely separate from that messed up lineup.
Oh, wow. So one procedural misstep could potentially unravel a whole case.
Yeah.
Why did the court decide to be so strict when it came to lineups?
They were really worried about the potential for error and prejudice, especially in a setting like that auditorium we talked about.
Right.
I mean, think about it. You've got over 100 witnesses all packed into this room, all focused on the defendant.
Right.
It's just a recipe for misidentification.
Right. I can see how that atmosphere itself, the sheer number of people, could really influence how a witness perceives things, whether they mean to or not.
Exactly. And the court really felt strongly that having a lawyer present was crucial to protect the defendant's rights in that kind of scenario. The lawyer could object to any suggestive tactics by the police or point out any irregularities that might influence those identifications.
Yeah, so the lawyer is almost like a watchdog, making sure that lineup is being conducted fairly.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got handwriting, which the court saw as more neutral, objective evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got lineups which are inherently subjective, more open to influence.
Exactly. And what's interesting is that this case was decided on the same day as another landmark case, United States v. Wade, which also dealt with the right to counsel at lineups.
So it's like these two cases working together really cemented this idea that a lineup is a crucial moment where you absolutely need a lawyer there.
Yeah, and they really highlighted those inherent differences between what we call testimonial evidence, like a witness's testimony, and physical evidence, like handwriting or fingerprints.
Yeah, it makes you wonder how those principles might apply to newer forms of evidence we have today, like DNA or voice recognition technology.
That's a good point.
But maybe that's a discussion for another time.
Yeah, perhaps.
For now, let's dig a little deeper into the court's thinking in Gilbert, particularly those different opinions about the handwriting samples.
All right, that's where it gets really interesting. While the majority of the court focused on that physical nature of handwriting, those dissenting voices, Justices Fortas and Black, they had some pretty strong opinions about how this ruling could maybe weaken those Fifth Amendment protections down the line.
Oh, I always find those dissenting opinions so interesting. What were their concerns?
They were worried that this narrow focus on handwriting being purely physical, it could kind of blur the lines, you know,
yeah,
potentially opening the door to making suspects give up other kinds of information that might actually be self-incriminating.
It's like they were predicting the debates we're having today about things like DNA databases or voice recognition software. They were way ahead of their time.
Absolutely.
Mm.
They were raising these fundamental questions about where we draw the line when it comes to evidence, how we balance individual rights with actually solving crimes.
Right. That's a debate that's still going strong today, especially with all the advances in technology.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got these different perspectives on the Fifth Amendment, but let's go back to those lineups for a minute. Why did the court single out lineups as needing a lawyer when handwriting didn't? What made those two scenarios so different in their eyes?
Okay, so picture this, right? Jesse James Gilbert is up on that stage in that huge auditorium.
Okay.
He's surrounded by all these other men, and there are over 100 pairs of eyes just staring at him.
Wow.
It's an intense situation, right? And the court recognized that. It's really easy for a witness to be influenced or make a mistake in that kind of setting.
Right. I can see how having a lawyer there in that moment could make a huge difference.
Mm.
They could object if the police are doing anything suggestive, make sure the whole process is fair. But why wouldn't a lawyer be just as important for something like a handwriting sample?
Well, the court did acknowledge that there could be some subtle pressure even in that scenario, but they ultimately decided it wasn't as big of a concern as a lineup. They said that the way you write, the way you form those letters, it's mostly beyond your conscious control, you know?
So you can't really fake your whole handwriting style, at least not in a convincing way. It's not like an actor putting on a different accent or something.
Right, exactly. Plus, those handwriting experts, they're trained to see past any little changes you might try to make and focus on those really unique, ingrained characteristics that define your writing.
Interesting. So while a lawyer might be able to object to something fishy happening during a lineup, they can't really influence the physical act of writing itself.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It really comes down to the nature of the evidence, how it's collected. And look, this isn't to say that handwriting analysis is perfect.
Right.
There are definitely arguments about how reliable it is as a science. But in Gilbert, the court was mostly focused on those constitutional questions surrounding the evidence collection, not so much the accuracy of the analysis itself.
Okay, that makes sense. So Gilbert basically drew a line in the sand lineups after indictment. You need a lawyer, no question. Handwriting samples, not so much.
That's pretty much it. And it's important to remember that this case didn't invent these constitutional principles out of nowhere, you know? It built upon existing legal frameworks, like something called the critical stage doctrine.
Ah, yes, the critical stage doctrine. Remind me what that is again?
Essentially, it says that certain points in a criminal case are so important to having a fair trial that the defendant has an absolute right to a lawyer during those moments.
Okay.
And Gilbert really clarified how that applies to lineup specifically.
So Gilbert was less about establishing brand new rights and more about saying exactly when those existing rights kick in during an investigation.
Exactly. It was all about drawing that clear line for both law enforcement and defendants. And, you know, what's really fascinating is that even though the case focused on these specific types of evidence, it also touches on a deeper question.
Okay. I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
It's about the nature of evidence itself, what makes something reliable or not.
Interesting.
Because think about it, both the handwriting sample and the lineup identification, they're ultimately trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Link the defendant to the crime,
right?
Establish their identity. But Gilbert says those two forms of identification should be treated differently under the Constitution.
So you're saying handwriting is seen as more, I don't know, mechanical, less about conscious choices, whereas lineups are much more subjective, open to all kinds of biases and influences.
Exactly. With handwriting, the court was emphasizing the physical aspect, like you can't really fake it. But with lineups, there's this undeniable element of human perception, memory, potential prejudice that can really affect the outcome.
Yeah, it makes you think, how reliable are eyewitness accounts anyway? There's been a lot of research showing how our memories can be flawed, how easily we can be misled.
Absolutely. And that's precisely why the court in Gilbert and in O.V. Wade put so much emphasis on having a lawyer present during those lineups. It's all about having an advocate there to make sure everything's being done by the book.
It's about making sure the process itself is fair, not just the outcome.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because some legal scholars actually argue that Gilbert's per se exclusionary rule for lineups, that rule we talked about, it might actually be too rigid.
Too rigid. How so?
Well, some say it doesn't always take into account all the nuances of a particular case. They argue that instead of automatically throwing out all evidence tied to a bad lineup, maybe courts should have a little more flexibility.
Oh, so look at each case on its own merits. Weigh the severity of the error against the other evidence.
Right. But those who support the per se rule, they argue that it's crucial to prevent police misconduct, to send a message that those constitutional rights are serious business. They're worried that any weakening of that rule would undermine those protections.
It's a classic legal dilemma, isn't it? Balancing reliable evidence with protecting individual rights. It's tough to find that middle ground.
It really is. And it's worth noting that some states have actually adopted slightly modified versions of that per se rule, so they allow exceptions in certain situations. So the debate continues even decades after Gilbert.
Yeah, it really shows the lasting impact of this case, how it's still sparking debate and shaping legal thinking. Okay, so we've covered the constitutional issues, those different views on evidence, the arguments over that exclusionary rule. But how did Gilbert actually change things in practice? How did it affect police procedures and legal strategy?
Well, one thing it did was really formalize the need for standardized lineup procedures.
Mm-hmm.
Before Gilbert, things were a lot more, I don't know, loosey-goosey. There wasn't as much focus on fairness or making sure the lineup wasn't suggestive.
So pre-Gilbert, lineups were kind of the Wild West, anything goes.
Pretty much. But Gilbert brought this need for structure and consistency to the process. And that shift towards standardization was reinforced by later Supreme Court decisions and also by those model policies adopted by law enforcement agencies themselves.
So are we saying that those super carefully staged lineups we see on all those crime shows with the numbered suspects and the one-way mirrors, that's all thanks to Gilbert?
Exactly. It's all about reducing the risk of a witness making a mistake or being influenced by unconscious cues or pressure from the investigators.
Wow, that's amazing how this one case affected even those small details of police procedure. It's like Gilbert said, hey, we need to take these lineups seriously. They can make or break a case.
Right. And it wasn't just about the lineups themselves. Gilbert also highlighted the importance of keeping detailed records of the whole identification process, from the initial witness interviews to the lineup itself.
Ah, the paper trail. Always crucial.
Exactly. Having those detailed records allows courts to really scrutinize how those identifications were made, you know, to see if there are any questionable tactics used.
It's all about transparency and accountability, making sure everyone's playing by the rules.
Exactly. And this focus on documentation, it goes way beyond just lineups. It's become a cornerstone of modern police work across the board.
So you're saying that even in investigations that don't involve lineups at all, the principles from Gilbert can still be seen in how evidence is collected and handled?
Absolutely. It's all about establishing that clear chain of custody, making sure the evidence is properly handled, and having a record of who touched it and when.
It's amazing to think about how much influence a single Supreme Court decision can have, not just on the law itself, but on how it's actually practiced day to day.
It's true. And this attention to detail actually benefits both sides, the prosecution and the defense.
Really? How so? I would think a clear chain of custody would mostly help the prosecution.
Well, yes, for the prosecution, having that airtight evidence chain makes their case stronger, makes it harder for the defense to challenge it. But for the defense, having access to those same records lets them scrutinize those procedures, see if any rights were violated.
Oh, I see. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, transparency and accountability for everyone.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder how these principles from Gilbert might apply to some of the newer forensic technologies we have today.
Right, like facial recognition or even DNA phenotyping. Now that's getting into some really futuristic stuff.
Right. I mean, these technologies are incredibly powerful, but they also raise all sorts of new concerns about bias and the need for safeguards.
So even though Gilbert was decided long before these technologies even existed, are you saying that the core principles from that case could still be relevant in figuring out how to use them responsibly?
Absolutely. The fundamental questions are still the same. How do we make sure these technologies respect individual rights? How do we prevent mistakes and bias? How do we balance effective law enforcement with protecting privacy and due process?
Those are some big questions for sure.
They are. But I think the debates that Gilbert started back in 67, they give us a really good framework for tackling these new challenges. We're kind of building on what they started as we enter this new era of forensic science.
It's like they gave us a roadmap, even though they couldn't have imagined all the twists and turns the road would take.
Yeah, I like that. And you know, another interesting thread running through Gilbert is this idea of the harmless error doctrine.
Okay.
Remember how the court sent the case back to the lower courts to figure out if using those messed up lineup identifications was a harmless error or if it actually affected the outcome of the trial?
Right. So even though the lineup itself was unconstitutional, the question is whether that violation actually changed the verdict.
Exactly. And it's not a simple answer. It requires a really careful analysis of all the evidence, weighing what the prosecution has against the potential impact of that flawed identification.
It sounds almost like a judgment call, a balancing act.
It is. And that's why the harmless error doctrine is such a tricky area of law. There's always a risk that a court might downplay the impact of a constitutional violation if they think there's other strong evidence against the defendant.
So even though Gilbert laid down this clear rule about needing a lawyer at lineups, things can get a little fuzzy when you bring in this harmless error idea.
Yeah, and this is something defense attorneys have to be really strategic about. They can't just assume the case is over because there was a procedural error.
Right.
They have to argue that the error actually hurt their client's case, that it had a real impact on the outcome.
So they have to show that the violation wasn't just a technicality, it actually mattered.
Precisely. And that can be a tough argument to make, especially if the prosecution has a lot of other evidence.
So even though Gilbert clarified the rules of the game, so to speak, when it came to lineups, there's still a lot of legal strategy involved in applying those rules to real cases.
Exactly. And that's part of what makes this case so fascinating. It's not just some dry legal precedent. It's a story about how the justice system tries to balance these competing interests, making sure the trial is fair, but also letting the prosecution build a case.
Right. It's about finding that balance where both of those goals can coexist.
Yeah.
Okay. We've covered a lot of ground here. From the historical context of Gilbert to those different legal interpretations of evidence, that debate over the exclusionary rule and how Gilbert changed the way police do things, what are some of the big takeaways you'd like listeners to walk away with?
Well, I hope they gain a deeper appreciation for how important Gilbert still is.
Yeah.
This case from 1967, it still shapes how we think about constitutional rights and law enforcement today. It's pretty remarkable.
It's a good reminder that even those old legal precedents can have a lasting impact.
Right. And I think Gilbert also really highlights the importance of procedural fairness. You know, it's not just about getting to the right result. It's about how you get there.
It's about making sure the process itself is just as important as the outcome.
Exactly. And Gilbert shows that the law is always changing. It's always open to debate and reinterpretation. It's an ongoing conversation.
It's a good reminder that we can always strive to make our systems better, more fair, more equitable.
You know, as we're wrapping up this deep dive into Gilbert v. California, I think there's one more layer to this case that's worth peeling back.
Oh, I'm always up for another layer. What do you have in mind?
It's this idea that Gilbert in some ways foreshadowed this debate that's even bigger today, you know, that tension between individual rights and collective security.
Okay, I see where you're going with this. But how does a 1967 case about handwriting and lineups connect to this huge societal debate?
Well, think about the core principles that are at play here, right? On the one hand, you have those individual rights we've been discussing this whole time, the right to privacy, the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, the right to a lawyer, all those protections that are in the Constitution.
Those bedrock principles that protect us from the government overreaching right.
Exactly. But then on the other hand, you have the government's interest in, you know, keeping things in order, preventing crime, keeping the public safe, and sometimes those interests can clash with individual rights.
Yeah, like when law enforcement wants to use surveillance technology or collect DNA from a huge swath of the population.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect examples. And those dissenting opinions in Gilbert, especially Justice Fortas's concerns about eroding the Fifth Amendment, those really get at that tension, don't they?
Yeah, they were worried that if the government can force someone to give a handwriting sample without their lawyer present, well, what else could they start demanding? Where do we draw that line?
Yeah, precisely. And that same logic applies to a lot of the technologies that we're dealing with today. Like, how much privacy are we willing to sacrifice in the name of security? It feels like it's becoming more and more urgent.
It does. And sometimes it feels like a zero-sum game. Like, any increase in security automatically means a decrease in individual liberties. It's so hard to find that balance.
I agree. It is tough, but I think Gilbert gives us a valuable lesson here. It reminds us that we don't have to choose one or the other. We can have both. You know, we can have individual rights and collective security. It's about finding that sweet spot, finding the right safeguards.
So it's not an either-or situation. We can have our cake and eat it too.
Right. And that's where legal precedent comes in. You know, cases like Gilbert, they can guide us. They give us a framework for approaching these issues, for weighing the costs and benefits.
It's like having a roadmap to navigate all of this tricky ethical territory.
I like that. And what's interesting is that the Gilbert decision itself doesn't completely resolve this tension. It leaves us with some questions.
Ooh, questions. I love it. What kind of questions?
Well, for example, the court acknowledges that there's potential for abuse, even with something as simple as a handwriting sample. They say that the police could, in theory, try to get a suspect to write something incriminating, even if it's disguised as just a regular exemplar.
So even though they ultimately said handwriting isn't covered by the Fifth Amendment, they knew that the process of collecting those samples could still raise some constitutional red flags.
Exactly. And that nuance, that recognition that things aren't always black and white, that's what makes Gilbert so insightful. It encourages us to think critically, to look at each case on its own, and always be on the lookout for potential overreach, you know, even when things seem straightforward.
Right. It's about having that healthy skepticism, knowing that power can be abused even when the goal is justice.
Exactly. And that vigilance is so important, especially now as we're dealing with these powerful forensic technologies. It's almost like the court back in 67 was giving us a heads up saying, hey, these new technologies are coming. Be careful how you use them.
Wow, that's a great point. It's like they were predicting the challenges we're facing now with facial recognition and DNA databases.
And it's incredible how many of the arguments from Gilbert are still relevant today, even though the technologies have changed so much.
It speaks to the enduring power of those basic constitutional principles. You know, the right to privacy, due process, a fair trial. Those are values that go beyond any specific technology or legal procedure.
Well said. It's about making sure those values are protected, even as the tools and tactics used by law enforcement continue to change.
So Gilbert v. California, it's not just about handwriting and lineups. It's a case that keeps prompting important discussions about individual rights, government power, and how we achieve justice in a constantly changing world. It's been a really fascinating deep dive.
Absolutely. It really shows how a case from 1967 can still feel so relevant and thought-provoking today.
All right, listeners, we've given you a lot to think about. Now it's your turn to explore these ideas. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Gilbert v. California.